Welcome to the Media Cat Magazine podcast. Thank you for tuning in for the next in our series, Rebel with a Cause, with me, Opal Turner. For this series, we are talking about the relationship between creativity and strategy, or in my other words, art, science, and logic. It's my pet theory that strategy and planning can be a creative secret weapon and that we overly separate the disciplines in our industry. Today we are talking to the incredible Josh Acapo, head of strategy at Archetype, a creative house for young thinkers and creators that move different. Welcome to the podcast, Josh. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, and thanks for the intro. I really like that.
Okay, so I want to get right in, because we've already mentioned Archetype, and I'm actually going to start with, you are a co-founder of Archetype, and just tell me, just for the listeners, just for the context, because our theme at Media Cat this month is age and wisdom. Just remind everyone how old you were when you started Archetype.
Okay, so the formal registration of Archetype happened when I was 18 years old, but the idea came when the three of us were 17. Like, we started off as a clothing company, thinking that we could simply purchase 100 t-shirts, whack a design on them, this is 2015, 16 times, and just sell all of them just like that with minimal marketing. Well, I mean, I did try. I was doing socials, and I really did try and give it a push, but with basically no paid spend, and just, you know, people would just buy it. So that didn't happen that way. And eventually we had a whole different name even before Archetype. And then we ended up rebranding to Archetype because our creative director, Jaden, he was playing around with designs one day, and he came up with just the letters Arc and Type didn't mean anything. And he literally messaged me and was like, you need to talk to Tom about this. And Tom's other co-founder was like, you need to talk to Tom about this. We need to change the name now. And I was like, okay, we'll do that. Changed the name, came up with the first design, top of 2016. Then, well, I did a thing where I was looking for Lovebox tickets in March, April. But I didn't find any discounted tickets. What I did find was this post that had like one or two likes, maybe one or two retweets, that was saying, we're looking for young people aged 16 to 25 to create festival merchandise with Lovebox Festival and a cool urban artist. And that urban artist ended up being Stormzy, who I think we could describe
an icon
more
of our time.
An urban artist, much more than that. And I literally.
The new song.
I mean, he's coming out of an album.
Everyone
like,
stop.
In what, a week?
But like, listen to it because it's dope.
Yeah.
Sorry. I got distracted when you said Stormzy. I don't
like. Not even. That's the normal response when you hear, yeah, we were like, whoa, this is the biggest thing ever. And then after that wraps up, we're like, okay, we can actually do this properly. We have a whole case study with a whole reputable festival and a whole artist. And it was so cool. And we were like, yeah, that's the proof point. Let's register this business. So that took me to the ripe old age of 18 years old.
How much like realization did you have at the time about what you were doing? Like, did you plan where you are now intuitively or practically? Because, you know, obviously right now you have a very strong influence and focus on youth and Gen Z, which obviously is in part because you are Gen Z. But tell me about how much that came into it at that point in time when you were literally 18. Brand new registered business. What was going through the three of your minds at that time?
It's a very weird thing to even think about, because we didn't even know what Gen Z, we weren't calling ourselves. It was, millennials were still the craze in 2015, 16. It was actually weird because a couple months before we started Archetype, I had just been made communications and media director at Joined Up Thinking. And Joined Up Thinking was a youth mentoring program that was started literally to help young people age 11 to 25 stand out and reach their potential. And I remember when I joined and I was like, I'm a glorified social media intern because that's all I'm really bringing to this organization. But like everyone on the board, like they were like really, really experienced and like had years and years and years and years working in operations for like either government, like organizations and public sector, or like food health and all that kind of stuff, or literally in mentoring and in youth support and in HR and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, okay, you lot have been in corporate for a while. And then also that's added on because like my mum is the one who founded it. So her asking me to come on was very like interesting at the time. And especially because like it wasn't a nepotism thing. I really wish it was a nepotism thing, but because otherwise it wouldn't have been like, because I've been like voluntarily being a director, and it's a youth mentoring organization. So it's not exactly like we get loads and loads of funding because government, I wish, please, government, I wish we could get loads and loads of funding. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. But it definitely was a thing where she was looking for like my expertise as just being a digital native and like knowing how the stuff worked and seeing the stuff that I was planning with Archetype and all that kind of stuff. So I already felt like I was a youth case study as to like rising careers and all that stuff before I even went to uni. You were like, okay, yeah, we're young people, but the generational difference isn't really what's driving us here. It's just the three of us. We're friends, we care about creativity, we care about culture. Yeah, had no idea we were
So
going to
what did you
eventually
think, like,
be
because obviously
even an
I totally get
agency.
that you wouldn't have just sat there and gone, do you know what our differentiator is, that we're a Gen Z agency and we make cultural content. But were you kind of, because it sounds like because of what all you were doing and what you were interested in, you were like, we can apply these skills and make sure that we're interested in.
Yeah, that's what it ended up being, I'd say. Sort of like taking what we had, and also I think that's a very important point. What we had, we didn't have that much, and this isn't to say that we were absolutely at the bottom of the rung in terms of who the working classes are, because like we did go to a grammar school, we were living in Kent, but at the same time, we weren't exactly the high flyers of that said grammar school. And in the town we were in, there was definitely a divide between like where we lived, which were the poor areas. But yeah, we weren't of that kind of like background where we could just access generational wealth easily. And I know my parents didn't let me get a job in school because they were very much traditional Nigerian, focused on your education. And it was just, we had to apply ourselves so that we could use what we have to make more so that we could be at least sustainable in some kind of way. Because we knew it wasn't like, well, this is 2016. My first election voting was the Brexit one. I saw how that result turned out. Yeah, I know, it was kind of sad. Saw how that result turned out. Knew kind of where the country was going from then. So it wasn't going to be a plain sailing smooth ride or a meritocratic rise in any stretch of the imagination. It was always going to be using anything we could and still understanding that that would only get us a shot at a potential, at a chance to make things here. So,
So true, so true. But you immediately went to entrepreneurship. I'd love to know why or how, or if you even noticed it at the time. You didn't go, okay, I'm going to use what I've got to get a leg up in the existing spaces, in the existing agencies, or any of the number of dope brands that exist that you probably could have easily gone and worked for. Why do you think it was that you went and, you personally, but also the three of you went straight to, we're going to do our own thing? Because I would love to know, because it's certainly something that's crossed my mind, how much it was not seeing a home for yourself or your philosophy in the existing agency landscape, the existing marketing and communications world.
Yeah, that is a very important question. And like I think at the beginning we didn't know how big the industry was. Like definitely after the Lovebox project, that project was the one where we got to see all the different components that go into making a campaign. And that was just an, well, not just, but that was an experiential campaign. That was very much like an merch campaign. It was not the biggest thing for Lovebox. Like we didn't literally go in and do their positioning and strategy and take all the sort of advertising big bucks and deliver a big creative idea. We didn't do that, but we did redesign all their merch and do the experiential bit in terms of selling it, making it an actual experience that people could engage with and interact with. We didn't even know that that was a thing when we were starting. And I guess like Some would call it naivety, some would just call it like lack of knowledge and all that kind of stuff. It was that got us into doing the Lovebox project in the first place. And the success of that got us to thinking that we could actually take this and run with it. So we ended up having like multiple clothing runs. We also kept doing the agency work, like sort of behind the scenes. We did Sam Henshaw's merch, we did DLT's merch, we did Hype Collective merch, our numbers merch. We did like some social bits for other like clients. We helped out Joined Up Thinking. We helped out some other like orgs and people who are currently part of the Friends of Archetype. But this was all while we were still a clothing company, and we didn't tell anyone about it because we were like, it's not really cool to be doing all this corporate stuff when you're trying to sell streetwear. So yeah, we didn't want to tarnish the image, tarnish the brand. We didn't want to do that. We made everything seem like they were one-off projects that just came to us, like they just dropped out of the heavens and all that kind of stuff. But really and truly, I think after the point of registering Archetype and then up until 2020, we knew the creative industries were for us. We tried to get in regardless of Archetype. Like we all had multiple jobs, like throughout our university experience, we all had multiple jobs. We were like working different things. We were trying to make ways for ourselves. And I've also been in ads, campaigns, commercials, done the modeling bit, been on both sides of the research sort of platform, done graphic design, web design, not illustration, can't draw, but but definitely strategy, research, account management, all that kind of stuff. But what we kept finding out is that we had to create our own opportunities at every step of the way because the industry didn't want to meaningfully hire us. And the word meaningful is doing like the real work there, because it's all well and good to, as the industry does now, have all of these junior roles that are open but only last for 3 months. And then after the 3 months, you're told that you're not quite the right cultural fit. And then you're told to go on your way and you're not really given a reference. But when we sit and analyze why that was, it is almost certainly because we're not from the accepted backgrounds of the creative industries. And not only that, because there is one argument for like the representational thing and the diversity thing, that's all well and good. But to be really honest, if the key players in the creative industries are benefiting from the lack of diversity and from the lack of representation and from the lack of access of people from the cultures that they actively take from to sell branded products, then, well, we're not getting it. And that was the story. I literally had a list of like the top 50 agencies that were based in London. And I started sending out, like, oh, hey, I'm Joshua Capo. At the time, I think I was branding myself as a multifaceted creative. I've done this, I've done that, I have this, I have that. Would you be interested for a chat? Silence. Even sometimes when I would get in the rooms and would book meetings and would like talk the talk, everyone would lie to my face. They'd say, oh my gosh, wow, you're such an inspirational young person. Oh my gosh, wow, it's so lovely to see someone of your background doing so well. And then when it came the time for, look, are there any roles here for me that would work? Are there any opportunities here for me that would work? Silence. It was only really like by 2018, bearing in mind that I'd been in the creative industry since 2014 doing music stuff, then pivoted to socials for that music stuff, then pivoted to Archetype, doing the clothes, then the Lovebox project, then we registered the business in 2016. Then now, okay, so that's 4 years from 2014 to 2018. You'd think someone with 4 years of experience would be able to get an at least entry-level job. But the first job that I ended up getting was at, well, the let me not call it the first job, because of course I was already working at Joined Up Thinking. Archetype was also a job and I was freelancing. But the first, what I'd call proper job that I was able to get was at Hype Collective. And they were like a startup youth marketing agency, well, student marketing agency. At the time, I think it was just Simon and Paul. And I was the first hire that stayed. And I was freelance because I wanted to be freelance. But still, they gave me that shot. And I ended up starting and running their Hype mentoring program. Helping to run their research, created podcasts with them, did new business with them, worked on accounts with them, all that kind of stuff, the publicity, like all of that stuff that comes with running agency. Even they even let me move to Madrid before remote working was the norm, like before COVID. Moved to Madrid as part of uni and was doing Hype Collective work sort of back and forth and was working remotely, jumping on calls and all that kind of stuff. Like that, fine. That was like, okay, right, finally, I have something stable that can allow me to do all of this other stuff. And that's when I also started working with NHS and like getting all of these different client bits for Archetype that we kept hush hush and all that stuff until 2020, when I was like, I don't think there's a full-time role for me anywhere, really and truly. So why don't I create my own that will manifest itself eventually? So at the top of 2020, we formally rebranded as an agency, and that's where it became like, right, we're doing our own thing. And this is like how we're going to make our mark in the creative industries. And then at that time, it was moving at the pace of culture and merch design and digital. It was a lot more, was a lot smaller considering I think the three of us were still in university by that point. And even though we'd amassed all this experience, people still don't want to hire people who are in uni. I don't know what that's about, but whatever.
I'm sorry, but like fucking wild. Like by that time you had had more experience than most, like probably midway in some places folk. Like I actually have no words, and that doesn't happen very often.
Honestly, it baffles my mind every single time I think about it. Because I'm not even sitting here like, oh, I'm the best strategist who ever. No, that's not true. Like, no, I can't literally, that doesn't make sense. But what I am saying is, if we're going just by the merits of like what we're doing, and not just me, also, this is not just me. Like I must say I'm very grateful to be in the position I am at now. It's working out, things are going well, all that stuff, fine. But it's also some of my friends, like I've got one illustrator friend who literally it took him what after graduation, like 4 years to get his first proper creative job, even though he had literally been like I hired him on like on freelance basis on like multiple projects with the literal NHS. And I'm like, the one of the biggest employers in the world hires you to work on their branding stuff for like the new experimental niche campaign stuff that no one was really doing at the time, and still it's taking you this long to get a creative industry job just because you're black and front end. Seriously.
Just cannot, like, it to your point, like it so thoroughly proves the myth of meritocracy. Like you on paper had more than enough, like a ton more than enough, and not just enough qualifications and experience, but really interesting qualifications and experience that were really relevant to what a lot of brands were trying to do at the time. Like you should have been being headhunted is what should that should have been the situation, let alone getting not getting jobs at places where people told you you were inspirational. I'm actually infuriated. It just so clearly proves the myth of meritocracy. It truly is a myth. Like you can say you want award winning, you can say that you want experience, and you can say blah 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 blah, but then somehow, some way, a cishet white guy will appear out of somewhere and get a job. And they've not done anything, and they're not that interested in working there, and so on and so forth. Like it's true. It just is true. It happens. We've all seen it. And you see incredible people of color and disabled people, and like all of these incredible people that exist in the world and actually really want it and are really willing to work for it and have all this life experience, like actual life experience. And you have to wait 4 years. It's really interesting how you described that journey there, because at the beginning it would have been at the when you first started telling like the origin story, it would have been really easy to be like, oh wow, look at the power of like a single opportunity. You've got the Lovebox opportunity, and then from there on it was just all the way up, right? And it's really easy to look at it that way, so I really appreciate you telling us the whole story, because it's never that straightforward, especially not for anyone who doesn't come from the a quote unquote typical background of people in our industry. And I really appreciate that, because I think so often, even when we do see stories of success, success is still the entire thing that we focus on. And if we just look for a hot second at all of the things that went wrong for that person who we now know is brilliant, and go, okay, well, if someone that good had to deal with that shit, then how are we still talking about meritocracy? How are we still talking about being interested in diversity and inclusion? It's not working. Like, you might be trying, but it's not working. Effectiveness. And I feel like a lot of the time people never ask that question of, did it work? And how are we judging how it worked? Because, we've spoken about this before. It's in my opinion, at least, some of the stagnancy and lack of effectiveness of a lot of comms work and advertising work is because of the fact that people all have, not all, but a lot of people in the industry have a very similar life experience from race or gender or health or wealth or class. And it is getting better in terms of general representation, but representation is not enough. If you go, okay, oh, 10% of our company is people of color, I'm like, cool, but what positions are they in? Because we know for a fact that women, people of color, working class folk, disabled folk, regardless of if your identity intersects one of those, because God forbid, we might get in, but we don't get to the top. And that is the next part of this discussion that I really feel the entire industry really needs to move forward on, because I still feel like we're talking about the most basic representation, and that is never and was never enough. It was the start of a very long journey.
Yeah. No, literally. And thank you so much for saying that, because I think there is such a convenient story we love to tell ourselves. And I think also, as marketers, advertisers, PR, communications professionals, we don't understand how brilliant we are at telling ourselves the stories we're trying to tell regular
Oh,
people.
oh my
And
God, yes.
this is one thing that is it makes me laugh, right? Because we talk about how like we use all these frameworks and all of this reading and all of these like philosophical concepts, which usually go above so many people's heads, and we distill it down. We do so much research, like qual and quant. We do so much like strategic thinking, creative thinking, concepting. We spend so much time delivering all of this stuff for brands that we forget we do it to ourselves, and then we fall for it again because we're not really in tune with the stuff that we're creating, and we're not also understanding its nature, its origin, its purpose. That's the thing. That's what I learned in history, year 12 history. Thank you so much, Mrs. Townend. Yep, taught me that. And no, honestly, like essential information, because I must say, we don't know that we have been spinning ourselves this lie that representation is it and is it and it's done. The second that we see like, oh, that's a black person over there. They work for XYZ agency. Yeah, amazing, amazing. Exactly. And we're just celebrating this sort of excellence.
Why can't we be mediocre?
Exactly. And this is my thing, right? So I see in my peers who are also agency founders, and they're doing great for themselves, and they make great work. But what one thing that I do notice amongst a lot of my peers who are from like more quote traditional backgrounds, by that I mean white, middle class, male, straight, all that kind of stuff, not neurodiverse, not disabled, all of these things, is that they were believed when they talked about themselves, and they were believed when they put themselves forward for opportunities. Whereas I have to prove beyond all reasonable doubt every single time I put myself forward for anything just because of my background. And that I think is a much bigger problem than we give it its weight for. Because the energy it takes someone like me, who is already dealing with the systemic oppression of living in the United Kingdom, which by now, if you are listening to this and you, even if you are living under a rock, you will know that systemic oppression does indeed exist in the United Kingdom. I think the past 45 days have proven that. If anyone knows what I'm referring to, you know. So, we know that this stuff exists, and we know it who it negatively impacts. So therefore, why, when people from certain demographics are trying to do the thing that you have been requiring from us for our entire lives, and that is pulling ourselves up by the bootstraps, working twice as hard for half as much, doing everything that we need to do, that we get into these rooms and we are still not believed just because of our backgrounds? Why are we not believed? Because this is not only because of unconscious bias and ignorance and all of those things that sort of remove the agency from the people who are perpetrating these terrible, terrible offenses, but actually it is because it is convenient to you to not believe me. Because if you don't believe me, then you don't have to do anything off the back of it. If you believe that I am a qualified strategist and researcher who has built an agency of a team that is now more than just his co-founders, it's now seven people, freelancers, but still core team, who has worked with brands from Lovebox Festival to Stormzy to NHS to Mental Health Foundation, and the list continues, then you will also believe me when I say I am still not even middle class. I know it might be hard to believe, but also anyone who works for a paycheck is not middle class. You are working class. And anyone who needs a paycheck to survive month to month is not middle class. They are working class. If you would believe the first part that I said, then you would believe the second part that I said, because you also believe the third part that I will say, which is, doesn't matter how many global brands I work for, systemic oppression will still get me because of my background. And therefore, that will call you to take all those three things and put it into this fourth thing, which is actual meaningful support for people with these backgrounds. It is more convenient to not believe any of that stuff, points one, two, and three, if you don't want to do point four. So you feel like you don't need to contribute to change.
I cannot get over the general and deep and abiding misunderstanding that people have that with doing the right thing, it can still be comfortable. It is not comfortable. If you, as a person with certain privileges, i.e. me, aren't uncomfortable, aren't, it's not costing you anything, then you're not doing it right. You need to give up something. Otherwise, it doesn't mean jack shit all. You're just doing it for your own, like, white savior complex.
Literally.
I don't understand why that's so hard to understand. And it's also a good thing for you, FYI, to be uncomfortable, to be challenged. And as you say, we talk about all of that stuff in the industry constantly. And it's the same. It's interesting that you said earlier that when you were younger, you referred to yourself as multifaceted creative, and now you're head of strategy at Archetype. And I refer to myself as a multidisciplinary creative and strategist, because it's wanky as fuck, I know, but that's the best term I can come up with so far. But I really feel like we are more likely to end up being multidisciplinary type folk when we've had difficult experiences. They force us to try different things. They force us to come at stuff from different angles. This is a whole nother podcast, but I have a theory that disabled people are the most creative people in the world, because from day whatever you get sick or diagnosed, the world doesn't suit you anymore and you have to figure out ways to work within it. It's literally creativity defined. I don't know a single disabled person who's not creative, etc. Different podcast. But my point is, we are forced to work harder, but work harder also means try more, because success doesn't come in a straight line. And so I feel like you are more likely to be multidisciplinary, more likely to be strategic and creative, or whatever your mix of things are, if you've been forced through different life experiences than most people. Your straight line was not easy. It didn't exist. Does that resonate at all?
No, absolutely. It absolutely resonates. And it's so very interesting that you say that, because so Archetype's just rebranded. This isn't really a shameless brand plug, but it kind of is. So we've just kind of rebranded in July for our sixth birthday. And we went from moving at the pace of culture, all that stuff, to move different. And the reason why we wanted to do that is because we noticed that the way even we were talking about culture didn't fit what actually happens in culture. So much as you've said, like, your theory about disabled people being the most creative people in the world, yes, because absolutely, as you said, the world is not created or even functioning to their benefit or even to their neutral. It's always to the detriment of people who aren't born or continue to be able-bodied throughout life. And that's nobody's fault. It's the fact that the world isn't set up for them is somebody's fault, but the fact that they are disabled is nobody's fault. And but despite that, they are still having to go through the world like this. And that is much like, in different ways, but much like any other oppressed group. And culture always, almost always, comes from those who are oppressed. I can look at it from literally anything that Black people have done anywhere in the world. But also, if I look at the Cultural Revolution of Ireland in the 1880s and the 1890s, if I look at the syncretized and the hybridized cultures in Latin America during the Middle Passage, aka the transatlantic slave trade, while that was going on. If I look at New Orleans, you know, if I look at like just so many different places, people, culture, where oppression has been forced on a group of people and they have had to fight back using cultures that are not only there to sort of do the meritocratic vision of lifting people out of whatever situation they're in, but also to serve their communities and to ensure their communities are surviving and thriving despite the scenario that has been put on them. That's what culture serves to do. And the archetype, we believe that people from whichever groups or whatever make up culture. Culture, well, people make up communities. Communities shape culture, and culture shapes people. That's it. People make up communities. Communities shape culture. Culture shapes people. If the culture that you in advertising or in marketing or in PR or in communications or in the creative industries at large that you are trying to either take from, sometimes appropriate, sometimes appreciate, sometimes use, utilize, invest in, whatever. If that culture does not have people at its center and sign off from the community, you will not impact the culture. So therefore, it is in your best interest to involve the people from the communities that shape and make up culture in every single facet and element of your, whether it be campaigns, projects, research pieces, strategic meetings, framework sessions, brainstorming sessions, brand sessions, all of that stuff and more. It is within your best interest to involve those people. And I'm not just talking about race or just talking about sexuality or just talking about gender. I'm talking about all of it because humans are so multifaceted. We contain so much brilliance within ourselves. There is so much in there to tap into for the benefit of, again, people who make up what? Communities that shape what? Culture. If I have to say it 500 times, I will. But yeah, no, absolutely. That's what we believe at Archetype, and that's what we do. So I would really just challenge the rest of the industry to, you know, follow suit, if you want.
Actually doing what you say.
Yeah, okay. You know.
Absolutely talking that we would imply such a thing. But I love it. I love it because you have such clarity of point of view. And I always say, like, what an agency is selling is inside our heads, right? It's our experience, it's our point of view on the world, which is all shaped by the communities we're in, the culture we're in, all that fun stuff. And then we just don't have those people in the room. We just don't have them in the room. And how much genuinely impactful work could we be doing? How much genuinely just nice stuff that might just make the world just like slightly better for a couple of days could we be doing by just bringing community in as you do? I feel like it's a lot. And it is that kind of authentic communication and collaboration with communities that I've just not seen anyone else do. And I've not heard a lot of agencies that are very big and very well renowned talk about their clarity of mission and vision and purpose as clear as you just did. Which, can we just remind everyone, you are 24.
Yes, I am.
Me losing my shit over here, but like, what the actual fuck? Because I imagine your that clarity of thought, that clarity of purpose, and all that stuff that you have built, is part of the reason that brands now come to you. They come to you for that point of view. They come to you for the youth that is in your team and the fact that you're actually connected with the communities they're actually trying to talk to. Is that accurate?
I would hope so. I absolutely would hope that's the reason that brands are coming to us. I mean, we sort of moved into this place just because we've always known that the sort of people, communities, culture thing. We've always known that, and we've always kept stayed true to that even before we were like shouting it from the rooftops. But I guess key players in brands, and they usually, I must say, a lot of our brand contacts usually have a story. It's not they have a story, they have an experience, they have a point of view of the world that is akin to putting people at the heart of it. They usually it's not the people who come to us like know that there is work to be done, and sometimes they might not even have the majority of the support in their own organizations, but they don't care. They are just so committed to that work, and they are so committed to the people that are going to effectively it's every single thing that we do in marketing, advertising, PR, and communications is involving and shaping people. That's what we do. It's yes, we make profits for companies that have so much profit already, but we absolutely shape people. At the end of the day, if there is a situation where all of a sudden the money that we have now is no longer worth what it once was, if the assets that we have now, if the things that humans have created that we have now are no longer what they are, what will we have? We will have people still. We will still have ourselves. So all of the work, all of the impact, all of the thought processes that we're supposed to be creating are supposed to be for shaping people. And the brands that come to us want to move different like that. The brands that come to us want to either better understand people, they acknowledge maybe a flaw somewhere, maybe they think they do understand it all, but they have that same goal at heart. And that's the advancement of people's an actual progression and actual things that like help out. Because I don't even like to call ourselves an agency. I would rather call ourselves a creative house because the stuff that we are working on and the things that we are doing are not agency things. Like I get every agency like has multiple content reels and all that kind of stuff now, but we are not even just so look at our Twitter. Look at the things that we retweet. Look at the things that we like. It is a reel of the pulse of a generation. It's the things that are going on. It's the real voices. It's what's actually being said. It's what's actually being heard. It's not this typical stuff you'd find from an agency that's trying to please every client under the sun. It is literally just a reel of what's going on in culture as it's going on. All of that stuff. But why don't you take this hard-earned cash or hard-fought-for investment and do something with it that will actually not only ensure that you're doing good in the world, doing good in society, reducing harm, which, to be honest, that's my barometer of what is good and what's not, ensuring that harm is not a thing that we inflict on ourselves as human beings and on the planet as human beings and as other living on other living things as human beings. That's my measurement. But also, let me be very frank, business cap on, have a degree from King's in business if you want to check that one out. Why don't you ensure that your brands are future-proofed in communities that are only growing? One third of all people are going to be disabled by the time they end their lives. That is not something we can just sit and look and say, oh, that's so sad. Oh my gosh. Because when it happens to you, you will not be sitting there and saying, oh, well, that's so sad. You'll be sitting there and thinking, oh, well, why can't I navigate in this world that I'm supposed, this is my only home. So you'll instead be thinking, okay, who are the brands that are? Who are the companies that are? Who are the organizations that are? Who are the not-for-profits that are? Who are the governments that are actually helping my life? And I'm telling you for a fact, point blank period, when you are from a community that is that marginalized, that is that oppressed, that is that down out, trodden upon by society, when you find that one sliver of hope, you cling on to it. You hold on to that so fervently. You are more loyal than your ABC1 white middle class consumers because you haven't had that easy ride. You know the value of things. I'm not saying that other people don't, but you just know how precious these things are. So when you find that loyalty, it's much like, for example, black women in hair care. When they find a brand, and look, me with my locks, I can definitely speak as not as a black woman, but as somebody who has black hair that they're trying to care for. When I find that product that works for me,
I couldn't pry it away.
never, not in a million years, not
The
in a million
brand
years.
love, the brand loyalty of underserved communities, I believe it's like 100x on your average person, quote unquote. Like 100x, but the long-term value of that customer, can we just all take a second for long-term brand thinking? Why is this still so hard to talk about? And it's got so much worse the more and more prevalent digital communications has got. We cannot think more than 6 months ahead, and it disturbs me. Also, great read. I was just listening to this week. Future Demand, really great book. Thoroughly recommend. Also, the whole thing is available for free on Spotify, so just go check that out. You'll see what I'm talking about. Why do we not think more than a couple of years ahead? I mean, to the point where I actually have a little Instagram that I do called Chronicasty, and it's all about why can't all of the objects of our lives as disabled and chronically ill people be as luxury and beautiful as any other product that we spend ludicrous amounts of money designing and putting out there for three people to use? If there's a solid gold plated pen, why isn't there a solid gold plated hearing aid?
Wow.
I'm just putting it out there. If anyone wants to make any of my products, let me know. Because at the moment, I generate them all on AI because they do not exist in the world. I use DALL-E to generate these products because they literally do not exist in the world. And even then, it struggles. It struggles to understand so many aspects and items, like literally the size and shape of items like stoma bags, because
Wow.
literally on the internet, the field of data that it was
Oh,
trained
wow.
on, there's very little photos of people with an actual stoma bag on. They're on a flat surface. It has no idea what size they are. Right? I feel like I just did a massive plug for my own Instagram then, but it's a little project that I just feel very passionately
Yeah.
about because of this community. And I think disabled people can also be rich. Disabled people can be chic. I try. Disabled people can be sporty, which literally blows people's minds. And so all of these products, there's this whole untapped market, and I'm like, I thought capitalism was about making money.
Well, this is the thing, and this is a very key thing with capitalism that I think a lot of people don't understand and simultaneously uphold. There are also key pillars which it feels as though it must uphold to keep the inequality that favors only a few people who are playing the game of capitalism. We are all forced to play this game, but there was a time where not as many of us lost out. And now more and more of us are losing out. And look, whatever we want to say about profit, people, planet, whatever, people can come up with their own percentage splits of how they view that. But what I will say is that if we have a system in the world that is literally not even doing what it professes, AKA being the most efficient with resources and distributing them to the players in the free markets that are the most deserving, then maybe it's time we rethink what that system is. And especially marketers and advertisers, we know, like we often look towards investment bankers and hedge fund managers and VCs and people like that as the ones who keep the wheels of capitalism moving. I actually would disagree. I would say that even though our industries might not be worth as much because we don't sit around looking at screens and making six zeros go into nine, go into 12, go into 15, et cetera, we are the ones who ensure people keep spending. And we are the ones who give people an ideal, an aspiration to look forward to so that they continue going to work, paying taxes, and upholding governments. Let me be very real. Even now, what we can see in the UK is going through a constitutional crisis, a political crisis, an energy crisis, a cost of living crisis, an inflation crisis, a pending recession crisis,
Crisis central over here.
literally crisis central over here. Honestly, if the UN wants to send us any aid, I would take it like seriously.
They could just send a competent human being. That would be great.
And even that lettuce that everybody has put on the front of the
I
Daily
would.
Star, even.
You're gonna love this. So I made a comment yesterday, and I had to put it on the. I have to say it on the podcast because I really thought I was very funny. But I am voting Larry the Cat for the next PM because I think that his political policy would be warmth and food, and that is what we need in the world. is someone who values warmth and food. And I'm not even kidding. I genuinely think the cat would do it better.
Yep.
Because cats value warmth and food, and apparently Tories don't.
I mean, not going to lie, Larry the cat is on his, what, fourth premise now? How many has it been?
I feel like he's seen them all.
Wow.
He knows what not to do.
He does. And yet, warmth and food, if this is the thing, we can't even guarantee warmth and food. And we're sitting here wondering why people are still continuing on with their lives, still continuing on with their jobs, still continuing and keeping on. Because people are like, even though we might sound bleak all the time, we are inherently helpful because we keep living. We don't just stop. We keep living. Even the most down and out of us, like literally, we keep going. And that is inherent hope that we have built in, baked in. And advertising and marketing for a very long time has been keeping up that hope, but doing so in a way that encourages excess consumption, that encourages inequality, that encourages people to do things that would actually be outside of their best interests, all to serve the needs of a few people. Whereas what I think we're both saying here, and what some other like key voices in the industry are like saying, but oftentimes it goes on deaf ears, is that why don't we, for a change, try and do this thing where instead of putting profits at the center of everything we do and shareholder value at the center of everything we do, let's put people at the center, and those very people will back you when it matters. I'm saying point blank, period. The people, the organizations, the not-for-profits, the brands, the governments that put people at the center will be the ones that will be supported in future when you need the people's support.
It's about what we value, isn't it? And it kind of comes back to where we were at the beginning in terms of age, because we simply value the wrong things. There's obviously huge structural issues that are stopping people from marginalized groups getting into top positions, but I do think that age is still one of them. What's your point of view on that as someone who, you know, started their own business at 18?
Yeah, I mean, you know what, it's really interesting about that, because when I was younger, I did used to think that, right, stereotypically, the oldies have got it wrong. It's all about the next generation. I used to definitely think like that. And it was where I realized that value comes from everywhere and value comes from everyone. And I wish it were like less sort of cheesy or less simple than that, so that we could like, you know, sort of kid ourselves with like, oh, but it's a very complicated solution. No. Honestly, value comes from everywhere and value comes from everyone. I think a lot of times in the industry, again, sort of the ideal that we have been marketed by ourselves oftentimes, yeah, we have these pillars in society, white supremacy, ableism, your cis heteronormativism, your patriarchy, etc., that make it so much easier to build the case for one believed voice and to shut out the rest of them. And that believed voice, I guess, now is probably getting a bit younger, maybe even younger than 40s and 50s, even though 40s and 50s, I think, in the workplace is still quite very young. Like, if the retirement age is, what, 65, then 40s and 50s is like, okay, people, if that's what you want, fine. But now it seems like it's a 35-year-old founder. Now it seems like it's that. Now it seems like it's like that the person who's like, you know, risen up the ranks really, really fast, all of a sudden they're, and it is the people who, like, usually they'll have a background of almost exclusively servicing clients and client needs. And they will either go in-house brand side and become really senior, or they'll set up their own consultancy and become really senior that way. And I'm like, is that the only path you lot have trodden out? Like, is that it? Is that the only ideal? And I guess when I was 18, I was a lot more oblivious to that, and I just thought, you know, everyone was, I, you know, I was a fully paid up member of the center left, believing that meritocracy was real and that if I did work hard, I could be something one day, but also understanding that there were certain things in place that just made my life just that little bit harder. Now I think y'all can guess where I am, but at the same time, I very much understand that, yeah, just people have looked at me in, or heard me speak and heard this accent, which might not sound, look, I don't want to do the thing of people sounding black or sounding white, but I absolutely know it, what goes on in people's heads when I speak is, oh my gosh, she sounds so eloquent. Oh my gosh, she sounds so well spoken. And I'm like, I went to school. We all are, all of us, whether you're speaking like this and all that kind of stuff there, or whether you're speaking in this accent, whether it's from someplace outside, or whether I'm speaking in this accent, which is the main one that I have, it doesn't matter. Well spoken is well spoken. It's just how you use the English language, and the English language has many forms, whether it's multicultural London English or African American vernacular English or Nigerian English or regional English, that from Yorkshire to Cumberland to Northumbria to all of the different places. Language is language, and all of these kinds of things. But we keep creating these cases to get other people again believed on top of others. And when it comes to age, I'm like, look, just because Archetype is an agency that focuses on young creators and thinkers who move different and have a core team that's like that's 24 and under, like all Gen Z, does not mean that we don't also have the backing of people who have been in the industry for time. And like we've just moved in with Ridley Scott Creative, but the people who got us in there, Kai, Rich, Christine, like I'm just pointing out those three people specifically because they are senior in this industry. Kai is the global managing director of RSA Films. Rich is the chief operating officer of Ridley Scott Creative Group, and Christine is executive creative director there. They are all experienced in age and in experience. But if I sat here and thought that, oh, just because they're what, in their 40s, 50s, and all that, that maybe they don't know what's going on in culture, that's, they couldn't be further from the truth. I have chats regularly with Christine about Daily Paper and about like all the stuff that's going on down in culture in streetwear. Like, I know she knows, and she's great. She's like, she knows the stuff. And
And it goes both
I hate to sound
ways.
like, and it goes from, exactly like the same way I look, me, I'm a historian at heart. I've been following UK politics since I was literally 5 years old. So I absolutely will be able to tell you some of the key policies of Thatcher's government, of John Major's government, of what happened on Black Wednesday, of why and how Tony Blair got into power, of the education, education, education speech. I might not have been alive, but I read a book.
Shocking.
It goes both ways. I know, right? Crazy, crazy concept. But it goes both ways. Like, value is exists where value is found. If someone in your team is not fitting the ideal that you've created for yourself to make it more convenient for you to be in the creative industries, then maybe that person in your team isn't as much of a valuable asset as they as you might have thought. And that often goes for people who have been believed their entire life. I sit here and think, who are we believing and why? Just stop believing anything and start questioning everything and just start finding value in things that are valuable.
And I almost feel like because it is so simple, I'm really into radical simplicity at the moment, but because it is so simple, people are like, it can't be true. If it's that simple to say value comes from everywhere, then does that mean we've got everything wrong? No, but does it mean we've got everything right? Absolutely not. Like, and it is hard, and I genuinely believe it is hard for us to believe simple truths at this point. And we could talk for hours about why that potentially is. But that's what I think one of the things that you've absolutely fucking nailed is the radical simplicity of how you approach your work and the world. Like, everyone go check out all of their work, obviously, but on your website, you're literally like, what do we do? Thinking. Thinking. We use thought. And that's all that strategy really is. Like, we overthink what strategy is, pun very much intended, because then we're like, well, then we can charge more money for it. And then we can have more people to do it. And it's like, it doesn't need to be that way. What are we doing? And so I'm so interested, like, that radical simplicity, you start there. That's what you put out in public. It's not like you're talking the talk, and then behind it, you're like, but yeah, really, I can do it in 10 minutes. You are saying it's thinking, and that's what we do. We think and then we apply. And so with that approach and in the context of the work you do you think it therefore continues to apply some simplicity
to yourself because of the story that you're telling yourself about what you do? And do you think that that also, I'd just love to know, based on the awesome brands that you work with, does it have to be that way? Because culture moves fucking fast if no one's heard. Like, that simplicity, if we can get simple quicker, if we can be smart and fast, that's a good thing, no?
I mean, I would have thought, you know, and I can't lie, I can't even take full credit for how simple everything sort of reads and I guess is at Arctype, because as I said before, when we first started as an agency, our proposition was simple, but moving at the pace of culture in merch design and digital, creating impactful moments with communities in, I still remember it because I said it so many times, with brands, artists, movements, and more. That's how I was saying it. And whilst that is simple and it makes sense, you should have seen the list of services that I had on our quotes deck on our website back when it was open. It was this thing, and ethnographic this, and strategic framework that, and
I promise I can do it all.
All these words. Yeah, literally, I promise I can do it all. And that was because I was coming from such a place of, I have to be better than the sort of like immigrant mentality mindset of like, you've come to a country that does not accept you. So in order to succeed or even survive, you have to go above and beyond to like, show that you are worthy and all that kind of stuff. But really, it was the team. This is why. Get a team, everybody. Teams, amazing people, like all of them. You have your thing, your why, and your proof point. That is all you need. And they kept saying that. But with that, I definitely developed this sort of mindset of, oh my gosh, I have to justify everything. Oh my gosh, I have to prove everything. Just because we weren't doing things traditionally. But the reason why our services can and like what we do can be split into thinking and creating is because that's it. Like, I don't have to add anything else. And more importantly, my team didn't want me to add anything else, because if I had any sliver, 1% of justification, I would have. Because I still have that imposter syndrome sometimes. And I still think that like, oh my gosh, how is it me from this background, from this place, who is in these positions, in these rooms, in these circles, in these spaces? I still think that. So honestly, I can't credit the team enough. Like, they are the ones who like kept me grounded. And as you said, yeah, us having a process this simple does, in fact, keep my thought process in simplicity. And yeah, that is really just it. I can't lie, it's made my life a lot easier, because now I don't have to sit and write 100-page decks just to prove one single line of strategy. I can instead prove one simple line of strategy with,
and it's just beautiful.
That's the tweet.
It's just beautiful. But it is interesting because it actually circles all the way back to where we started with the stories that we tell ourselves. Because I'm very much the same. Like, I, one of my first memories is I would not be able to go to school, blah, 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 blah. We internalize that if we are going to prove those people wrong, then we need to go above and beyond. We need to do everything and so on and so forth. But it can work. And you have shown that it can work the other way, because your team went, no, it can be simple. We promise it's okay. It can be simple. And it worked. And so now that's the story you tell yourself. And it's that's what other people want to hear too. Because shock horror, we don't actually like being sold to in an aggressive manner. And we try not to do it with our actual work. And then we do it to each other in meetings. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I'm just going to show up as a human being. And if you don't like me as a human being, that's totally legit, because then we shouldn't work together. But if you do like me as a human being and you do think I'm not a complete idiot, then it's probably us worth talking about what we could add to each other's lives and work and brands.
Yeah, exactly.
So I want to, because I'm so interested about your team dynamic. So you have creatives and you have strategists, obviously. Was there ever in your mind, because you have this complete simplicity of process, do you have processes in the way that you take on briefs, or do you take it each as it comes? Like, have you taken any of those points from kind of, you know, the traditional setups and processes that we use to get to good work at all? Or do you just go with it much more intuitively?
You know, it's actually a mix of both, because like sort of much as you said, like to an earlier point, like, does it mean that we've got everything wrong? No. But does it mean we've got everything right? Absolutely not. And there are some things that we do that actually make sense, like briefing when it's on less than 2 pages of A4. Yeah, there's a lot of things that we sort of do that gives us a process. So with nuanced thinking sort of comes nuanced process. And that's basically what we do with every single brief or project or idea or even like line that we get. We sit down, all of us, we have those meetings like, are we going to take this project? Are we not going to take this project? Or I'll chat to everyone individually, pick up the phone and be like, would you be interested in working on this? If so, why not? And it was just that simple, because I'm not going to force someone to do something that they don't want to do. And there's plenty of stuff that we've got going on. We're literally developing a platform for cultural exploration called Art Docs that has so many different things getting off the ground. So I'm like, yeah, help us build that. And that's absolutely fine. And that's sort of part of the process, just in ensuring that the people who are working on the project actually want to do them.
And that's the thing, it's like that one-on-one process, that human process of do you want to do it or not, is up until about 60 people doable, in my opinion. Like, you can just ask. Like, if you've created an environment that is conducive to honesty and openness and inclusion, then you can just go, guys, hands up, how are we feeling about taking this brief, yes or no? And again, it's that radical simplicity of just ask people. And you might be surprised, you might not be surprised, but, you know, ask everyone every time. So that strategist over there might actually really want to work creatively on this one thing because they have a sub-skill in that area and they are involved in that community and it's totally relevant for them. And you've just literally just nailed it in the simplicity of just ask. And that goes so far beyond titles and experience and all of that stuff that we hold so tightly and that we value so highly versus just, are you really excited to work on this? Yes, then it's probably going to be good that you work on it.
Yeah, it's literally that. Like, I know what it is like to, I guess this is the only reason why I can do that and why I guess like also you can do that and why it makes sense to us is because we've probably worked on a few projects that we didn't want to do, right?
I mean, yeah, I think that's true of everyone.
Exactly. I mean, but from how some people treat their team, you'd think that it wasn't true for anyone. Mm. Like, you'd think that, and look, I'm more than aware that there are things in every single project, no matter who the brand is, that we don't want to do.
Yeah, of course.
I am more than aware of that. I'm more than aware that there are certain parts of, exactly, life is still life, work is still work. All of these things are still, like, there are some necessary, not evils, but things that might feel evil, like track and time, that feels evil. I don't like doing that. It's not my favorite thing, but I know there are things that we have to do in order to keep the thing going. So we do those things to keep the thing going. But when you give people agency over what they are actually doing and explain, all right, this is why we do this. So I understand that if you don't want to do it, that's still fine. But this feeds into the bigger vision. You're more likely to get someone sign off and someone's like buy into the idea. And all of us sort of mm-hmm. take on the mantle of like doing accounts and like managing sort of client stuff. I think that's like really important. That's something that I learned from Paul Stollery at Hype Collective and Hard Numbers. He's very big on like everyone, no matter if you're account manager or not, should be able to at least know the skills of running an account just so that you can have that organizational backing that also enables you to see how the accountability sort of works and moves through a system and all that kind of stuff.
I kind of know your answer to my ultimate question to wrap up with, because we've kind of mentioned it a lot of times throughout this, and it is that value comes from everywhere, and so we can all use each other. But just to wrap up, because this is already going to be the longest episode we've already done because me and Josh can talk for hours. what are your thoughts on my theory that creatives need strategy and can make better use of it?
Oh, yeah, 100%. I really do agree. Creatives, you know what, it even goes both ways. Strategy is strategy can be that simple sometimes. It worked for a competitor, so it will work for you. But you have to have a proof point of that. And that proof point is research. It's an insight. It's a cultural norm. It's an eternal truth. It's something that like is resonant with more people than just you. And again, it's that sort of mentality of, because I am in this role, because I have the pomposity of like, oh, I'm a creative director, or oh, I'm a head of strategy. What does that mean? unless it's functional for your job. Like me, literally the only reason why I call myself a head of strategy is because I have a team under me who, well, with me, not again under me, but with me, who like work with me to deliver projects. Like that's the only reason why I call myself head of strategy, just because I'm leading on those projects. Otherwise, I
because
would
just... leading is a different skill.
Exactly. Exactly that. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but I'm all for like having job titles that are functional. But it is that like mentality with thinking about back to creativity and strategy. Your creativity should always have a proof point that is rooted in some strategic thinking, but at the same time, that strategic thinking should be workable for a creative. Like, yeah, that kind of, again, simplicity where for us, and hopefully for like the rest of the industry, I know a lot more teams are doing this. Our research and strategy is overseen by our creative teams, and our creative is overseen by our research and strategy teams. And I think it is just that easy to, you know, get, we're a small team. So I must admit it is easier for us to do this than a sort of big four ad agents. It is easier, but still.
Like we could just talk to one another as equals. And like listen to each other's point of view and value each other's point of view. Just saying.
Yeah. And that is a just saying that needs to be said again and more by like so many people. Listen to what the value in everyone is saying.
I literally can't think of a more perfect way to end, specifically since this is a podcast. Listen. Josh, this has been such a great chat. Yeah. I don't know how I'm going to edit this down. It's going to be impossible. But thank you so much for this great conversation, for your honesty, for your openness, and yeah, thank you for coming on the Media Cat Magazine podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on the Media Cat Magazine podcast. Like honestly, this has been I've enjoyed this a lot.